I'm Frank Vaughn. It's August 19th, 2026. You may have heard that Canada and the U.S. have reached a tentative trade deal. We're going to get into that. But I think as a baseline, we need to understand just what Canada is and our position when it comes to the world right now. And someone asked me, so in your honest opinion, what will happen going forward, Frank? I hear arguments from both sides that either one, Trump and Carney, are working together, or two, Carney is working for the Crown to hinder Trump's ability to, the rest of the post doesn't really matter. I asked him, what happens to grain when it's caught between two millstones? 336 views, only three people like it. You need to understand that Canada is an asset to be managed. And this idea that there is conflict, an overwhelming and overarching conflict between the Crown and Donald Trump, is part of the overwhelming mythos that has taken over the public mind, taken over the masses. The masses need their narratives on both sides of the aisle, and it works both ways. But, I mean, Trump himself has had nothing but good things to say about King Charles. He hosted him in Washington for three overnights in 4 days. What do you think was discussed? And I believe that was their third meeting. Carney is a king's man. For sure, he does not wear the Canadian flag. He wears the symbol of the Order of Canada, the king's symbol. But what is actually happening? Mark Carney, as I've highlighted before, is a Goldman Sachs Brookfield man. He benefits when America is strong. His portfolio increases in value when Canada and the United States are integrated. And I've maintained all along that the elbows up optics is nothing but opiates for the masses. There's a lot of people in this country who need to be fed narratives, and Carney is more than happy to provide. He's very good at it. But underneath the surface, there's coordination between Carney and Donald Trump. It goes back a long way, but there's coordination since he came to office. I genuinely believe that Justin Trudeau screwed things up so bad, even though he's of the same ilk. He was, I mean, you watched the video yesterday. You saw him with the plunger dancing around the store with Katy Perry listening to pop music. That's more his speed. And I believe that under him, he was screwing Canada up for their plans. So he was so inept that he was breaking things for the people that he is part of and party to. The CBC today, Trump says he's brokered a very good deal with Canada after pausing the 50% tariffs. Now, we don't have a full text, so of course we have to reserve our full judgment for when we actually get all the details. But the leaks that have been published in the Globe and Mail and other places show that there is going to be a drop in retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods. That's predictable. Provincial governments and bans on U.S. alcohol sales, again, predictable. But agree to the U.S. interpretation of how licenses and quotas are allocated under Canada's supply-managed dairy system. Broader access for U.S. products. This is a capitulation to Trump. Comprehensive market access for all American goods, economic security commitments, digital trade alignment. I highlighted probably over a year ago now that at the height of the elbows-up rhetoric, the administration of this country was coordinating with the United States on the Genius Act to make sure that whatever regulations we brought in, they mirrored the United States. And I highlighted that in the midst of all of this rhetoric that is consuming the public mind, underneath the hood, there is widespread coordination still ongoing. And this is more to the point. Let me read that again. Comprehensive market access for all American goods, economic security commitments, digital trade alignment, and other provisions. Digital trade alignment could involve residual issues around prior Canadian digital policies, so the removal of our digital pricing. I've been saying this for a long time, and I just don't know. How much the truth matters anymore. I don't know how much trying to find reality matters anymore, because narratives are always so bloody powerful. I mean, one of the biggest narratives right now is that Trump is in this fight to the death with the City of London. It's partially true. There is a struggle as to who is going to emerge at the top of the Western heap. The whole plane is going down, and we're fighting over who is going to be the captain of the crashing plane, which is fine. I mean, the process of reorganizing the West leads back to Fortress North America, which I think is the only game in town. That's why I'm so dead set against the Iran war, because the Iran war only serves the interests of one nation. And there are people out there, and there are, as far as I'm concerned, intelligence operatives that are working in social media to convince you that the Iran war isn't about advancing the interests of that nation, that it's really about the crown and about Lloyd's of London and a bunch of other nonsense. And people buy this, and bots posted in my comments section. And I keep seeing it coming up. I get emails from people talking about these videos that they've watched online and how I just need to watch those videos and I'll understand anything or everything. All they need to do is open their favorite AI tool, because most of these people, the only thing they can do is go, Grok, is this true? ChatGPT, is this true? Gemini, is this true? As if they're not misleading you through the AI. Like, I mean, AI is useful, don't get me wrong. But you need to know how to find its weaknesses. You need to know how to find its programmed blind spots. So not really blind spots. They're deliberately not seeing what's there. If you just go to your favorite AI and you ask your AI, what percentage of global shipping is insured by Lloyd's of London? Well, you'll get your answer and you'll understand. It should lead to an understanding that pricks the bubble of the story that it's all about Lloyd's and the Persian Gulf. 7% is the number. Other insurers make up the bulk of global shipping insurance, and Lloyd's will still be a player if and when the dust settles in Iran, and that's doubtful. I mean, I genuinely believe that the rumors of talk of tactical nuclear strikes on Iran are true. I'm not sure what else the United States can do. I see people every single day talking about how the United States will just invade Iran, we'll do a ground invasion, we'll take them out. People are so ignorant of logistical realities. Like, they don't think deep. They don't think things through to the end. They don't think about how if the United States is experiencing problems supplying their naval vessels right now, as those naval vessels can't go anywhere near the Persian Gulf, how the hell are you going to land troops there? And you're not going to be able to land the 350,000 to 500,000, depending on how you want to score it, that were required to deal with Iraq, a very low and flat place, very easily invaded, where the Americans had air superiority. The Americans don't have air superiority over Iran, and Iran is not flat. It's four times the size, has all kinds of mountains. And the U.S. military does not have the personnel or the capacity to deploy those personnel, which is why I think nuclear weapons are probably on the table. But getting back to the point, I made a tweet and I said, if you've been watching me for any amount of time, you will not be surprised that Carney capitulated to U.S. demands on trade. It was always going to be this way. Carney is a Goldman, Brookfield man, and U.S. interests are his interests, elbows up. And the reason I say that is because I've been talking about this for a long time, that all the optics in the trade dispute, and I've been leaning this way, like I try to keep an open mind, because I don't want to be too sure of myself. But it certainly seemed that whenever Trump and Carney were in each other's presence, or whenever it came down to the wire, Carney had nothing but fawning positive things to say about Donald Trump. And his base completely ignores it. I mean, let's just check out, while we're here, and I'm in the midst of my rant, let me find Polywave. We'll go to Canada, and here we are. This is the averages. 42.4% of people still back the Liberal Party, 33% back the CPC. That's an average. I mean, you're going to be able to find Nick Nanos and his outliers that show the Liberals have probably got 80% of the vote now. It doesn't matter. They don't have to lie much. And I mean, at the same time, 12.2% for the NDP. That's where the country's mindset is. There's not much I can do about that. And I don't believe when we get full text of the trade agreement, when this thing flushes out, I'm going to be able to make a video point by point to show how Carney capitulated to U.S. demands more than any previous prime minister. And it's not going to matter. The elbows up base will flip their script. And you know how I know this? This is how I know this. In 2022, February of 2022, prior to and after, probably for the full year and a half after February of 2022. We all know what happened there. the Freedom Convoy. Displays of the Canadian flag were cause for suspicion that you might be engaged in some kind of domestic terrorism. Displaying the Canadian flag was dangerous. I know people who had phone calls from deep levels of the RCMP. Man, I know somebody that was contacted by CSIS. It wasn't over a Canadian flag, but it was over presence. I know others as well. This was where we were. And then all of a sudden, elbows up happened, and the Canadian flag was rehabilitated. And now it was okay to display the Canadian flag. It was okay to talk nationalist rhetoric, a unifying message, talking about the character of Canada and how it had to be protected from Americans who were going to take us over. The flag was rehabilitated, and the elbows up crowd, the people who have been hypnotized by the big red machine, embraced their flags again as though they hadn't 5 minutes ago been saying displays of the Canadian flag were a sign of sedition. They will flip their script again. They will follow the Liberals wherever they go. And if the Liberals don't go far enough, they'll go back to the NDP as they have. Can you imagine? In the wake of the Star Trek Federation weird convention that the NDP just had, this farce, this broken party that elected Jagmeet Singh, that on the cusp of power, near two, Jack Layton passed from some kind of aggressive cancer. Mulcair came along, tapped the brakes. They made Singh the leader after Singh's base took over the NDP because it was a wide open opportunity, a political opportunity to grab a federal party. Hello, who wouldn't do that? Canadians were standing down. Nobody cared about the NDP. Singh came in, took over, and bankrupted the thing. It doesn't even matter who leads it now. The 12.2% of respondents who are unhappy with the level of socialism or the level of corporatism that the Liberal Party is enacting in Canada would still support the NDP. The public mind is just broken. People don't know what is good for them. And so, when I make, inevitably, a point-by-point video showing that Carney has capitulated to U.S. demands on trade, things that they have wanted for a very long time, they're now going to get. I am certain of it. Because there's only one way forward. This idea that Canada doesn't need the United States is absolutely ridiculous. We are Siamese twins. We are tied at the hip, and we are the junior partner in a much bigger continent. And the only future for any of us is this continentalism, because the rest of the world lies oceans away. And these things, like, this is the other thing. People assume, because you can articulate a point of view that they like, that you're automatically going to articulate points of view that they like in a variety of other situations. The Iran war is bad. It remains bad. The United States remains broke. The Treasury buybacks are off the charts because now we're talking about 6% interest rates. This Treasury doubles debt buybacks as Bessent moves to steady bond market because bonds are wrecked. We were just fed a constant stream of media about how 5% bond rates makes the U.S. debt virtually untenable. It's already untenable. I mean, we're talking $2 trillion, a $2 trillion deficit, over one in five U.S. dollars going to just service the debt. Well, now we're starting to get articles about 6% treasury yields are the biggest risk facing stocks. They moved the whole thing up by 1%. Bessent's a magician. He's done wonderful things to keep the stock market elevated. A stock market being elevated, by the way, doesn't actually mean anything. They call it the most positive indicator that they can find. I showed you a bunch of charts yesterday, and in previous video work, I've showed you how much trouble the real economy in the United States is in, that people are still facing inflation, their dollars are under attack, their costs are rising, and the response from politicians is, but the stock market's up. The stock market is just a reflection of how much money is in circulation. The stock market is just a reflection of all the money printing that's gone on. You can have an economy that collapses and have a stock market that goes up 26%. I believe I talked about that in a previous video. The nation that I'm talking about. It boggles my mind how people can't sort different things out and look at them all individually and then feed them back into the whole. Everybody's got to have a cohesive, unifying narrative. And facts be damned. But back to Canada's favorite taxpayer-funded bullshit factory, the CBC. Look at the pivot already underway. It's not so much the headline. Trump says he's broken a very good deal with Canada. The picture's interesting, too, because his face expresses doubt. He's looking skeptically at Mark Carney. Think about what that does to the audience. But the subtext is, more talks about possible deal smoothing over trade irritants. You see how they're softly starting the narrative shift? Trump claims certain Canadian tariffs on U.S. goods will be non-existent. They will be. I personally don't understand how the elbows up crowd will not be shocked. And I'm saying this in advance. I don't actually know. But I'm pretty sure when we get the text of an actual agreement, it should be shocking to the elbows up people. The conservatives will certainly be up in arms about it. It's likely going to undercut and undermine the sacred cow of supply management. I don't think it's going to do anything. I don't think it's going to move the needle at all in this country. These three charts show where Trump's new tariffs could have the biggest impact. It's irrelevant. I don't believe those tariffs are going to hit. This is actually this guy. This soul-sucking, soul-selling greatest political disappointment of my life outweighs Bernier by a long shot. Ford's Texas trip to talk trade tariffs cost taxpayers over $93,000. Internal documents revealed. Do we do this? Does the CBC do this? For liberal politicians, do they do this for anybody except conservatives? It's like they've always got a very special place for coverage about things like the Second Sons or the Dominion Society. They've always got full page and all kinds of taxpayer resources to go after them, but they never talk about Khalistani supremacy or any of the other ethnic movements that are being imported into this country. They never really have that much dedicated resources for things like Chinese triads and infiltration of Canada by foreign governments, unless they're talking about Trump's mean tweets and how they might have interfered with the Canadian election. It's just brutal. But this guy sold his soul. And he's still getting examined for a $93,000 expense. I mean, Canada's running a $100 billion deficit this year. That's much more important. What's also much more important is the deficit that Ontario continues to run, as well as the other provinces around the country. $93,000 doesn't even matter. But at the end of the day, this is fake opposition. This is fake outrage. This is direction of traffic. This is to get the Canadian mind, this is to get the elbows up crowd to be distracted and angry at who they're told to be angry at, whether it's Trump or Ford. Meanwhile, their country is being managed from out under their feet. I think the smartest people in the room right now in Canada are separatists, whether they're Alberta separatists or Saskatchewan separatists or Quebec separatists. I think they can see, at least on some level, the nature of the game, which is that Canada, like I said, is like grain stuck between two millstones, getting crushed, getting managed. And they want out. They want a better deal. They want a better deal for their people. They want to get away from Ottawa. Hard to blame them. They want out from under the crown. Again, hard to blame them. But unfortunately, I don't think there's enough vision collectively in this country to actually embrace the quest for independence. I think the majority of people, like the polling shows, 56% of people support either the Liberals or the NDP, and that's not even counting the Greens. I don't think the Canadian public is ever going to wake up. And I know that sounds like a black pill moment. It's not really. But even the provincial legislatures, a year and a half ago, whether it was the Alberta government or the Saskatchewan government, I had a lot more cause to hope that they had the vision to break with Ottawa. And instead, I see them kowtowing to the talking points of the Liberal government. I see them more than happy to be under the thumb of Carney. I see them, once again, parroting Federalist talking points. I see Pierre Poilievre losing his seat, going to Alberta to get his seat again, just to tell the Alberta people that staying in Canada is the best for you. Engage and embrace your Stockholm syndrome, Alberta. You haven't been punished enough yet. Love your pain. And none of it moves the needle. So I feel like, and I remain convinced that the best place in Canada to be is Saskatchewan. I'm very happy to be here. It's a beautiful place. I actually just got interrupted on that last. I was in a bit of a rant and I had to cut because the municipality had arrived. And they don't just cut the road. They come all the way down my driveway and maintain the edges for me. It's awesome. It's awesome. It's awesome to see your tax dollars actually at work. They grade the roads. They keep everything in perfect shape. The indoor facilities are bar none, top tier, very family friendly, very encouraging of homeschooling. It's a wonderful place to be. But I think we are, one way or another, we're transitioning towards North American integration. And Carney is the architect of that. And there will be winners and losers on the bottom tiers of society, in the trades and working people that will win in the economic outcome once this is all sorted out. But if you're somebody that's actually into the nation of Canada for whatever reason, if you're one of these elbows up people, you're going to be sorely disappointed where we go. Because really, this can happen the easy way, which is Carney capitulates, he makes a deal, we carry on with business as usual, we focus our energy on trying to reach the president and get him to get out of the war in Iran before he goes nuclear. I mean, this is the most non-interventionist president there's ever been. Until this moment, until he went to war at the behest of Israel. And if you doubt that, if you think that's just anti-Semitic, I mean, all you got to do is listen to what Marco Rubio said. The Israelis were going to attack Iran anyway, and because it was assumed that Iran would attack U.S. bases in response, the United States joined the excursion. It's absolutely foolish. Now, when you look at it in the rear view, it might not have been as easy to discern at the time. Nobody knew how the Iranians would act. Nobody knew that they would be the rational actors in the room, which they are. Up to this point, during this conflict, they have only responded in kind. They've restrained themselves. They've only hit those countries. I shouldn't even say that. They've only ever hit U.S. assets in countries that support the United States military effort against Iran. We've been lied to so much by the United States and the Gulf Cooperation countries. There was outrage when Iran attacked the Saudi Arabians and the UAE and a bunch of different waves of the conflict. And it turned out that they were the ones, the Saudis and the UAE and the GCC were the ones that attacked first, that they had directly attacked Iran at the behest of their governments, against the will of their people who don't want anything to do with this. It's the greatest geopolitical disaster in American history, bar none. And anybody that's telling you some kind of magical story about it being a Trumpian 5D chess masterstroke about kicking Lloyd's of London out of the Persian Gulf, that is just opiates. It's so stupid. It's so abundantly stupid. The United States is there for one reason, and I would ask you to think about this. What does the Lloyd's of London story, what does the United States fighting the great British Empire as if the empire hasn't been in decline, if there's even an empire, in decline for the last 120 years, or at the very least since the Boer War, since World War I, World War II. I don't want to get into an extended history lesson. But even if you accept, or you want to accept that narrative as true, what does it serve to cover? And it covers over reality, which is that Israel has an outsized influence on the United States and its foreign policy. Israel has outsized influence in both political parties. There are wings of the Democrat Party that don't want to go along. They're in the middle of, I mean, after the midterms, you could actually see the Democrats fragment. The Israeli military is now being integrated into the U.S. logistics chain, into their chain of command. The Israelis are capable of calling meetings at the Pentagon. Find me a parallel in history where a foreign nation can call meetings at the highest levels of a partner government and can just walk around unfettered with access to all the information and intelligence that they want. It's such a lopsided relationship. I'll finish on this, and that is the midterms. And I don't know if I touched on this yesterday, but I'm not convinced that it's going to be a Republican route. I'm not convinced that it's going to be a Democrat route. I think the thing's going to be highly competitive. I think the Democrats have an edge, but there's a lot of commentators out there saying the Democrats are going to wipe the Republican Party out. And I'm not sure that that's so guaranteed. It is true that a large portion of the Republican voter base is pissed right off with Donald Trump for abandoning essentially the things that he campaigned on. I mean, come on. Epstein justice, really important to a lot of people. Lowering prices, that was really important to a lot of people. They're right back where they would be. Energy prices, I mean, we're talking about electricity, charges through the roof. All the problems that existed before he was elected still exist. A lot of broken promises. The independents that joined him are really pissed off about all of it. And then on top of those things, the war. However, as disappointed as they are, on the other side, you have a Democrat Party that is splitting in two between a very radical socialist wing that's very good with slogans and very short on details, but that speaks directly to the Democrats have a form of socialist populism that's starting to take over the Democrat Party. It's really starting to grow. And it's still in its early stages, but it's starting to make inroads to the point that the centrists in the party, the establishment figures in the party, are afraid to call it out and cast it out because it will split their party. And then on the other side, you've got characters like Ushoff who are beginning to make the case for centrism in the Democrat Party. But people are right to be fearful of that socialist wing of the Democrat Party. So like I've said before, it's like a choice between getting poisoned or shot. I'm not sure how the American voter is going to participate. You know, and I listened to, and I'm really glad people brought up some names because I've never really been a podcast listener before. I make videos. I don't really listen. I like to read. I do an abundant amount of reading. Like if there's a really good video, I'll try and find a transcript to read it. But I've been listening lately. And there are a lot of Trump voters or dedicated Republicans that didn't even bother participating in their primaries because they're apathetic, because they feel like there's no point. So what this tells me is that this election is probably harder to call than you might think on the surface. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure how the whole thing's going to flesh out. But I do think that another chapter of this war, the worst chapter of this war, is somewhere out there ahead. It's like we're driving down a road at night. I have no idea when we're going to hit this roadblock in the middle of the road. But I don't see Trump doing what he has to do, which is admitting defeat and getting out. I think he's got to try again. I don't think it will amount to anything. I worry. And I think there's a reason to be concerned that he would actually consider using tactical nuclear weapons on Iran. That is such a huge precedent-setting moment in global history if that happens. Because then what's to stop the Russians from doing the same thing in Ukraine? At any rate, I'm Frank Vaughn, and I'll see you in the next one.